LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour.
Hello, and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Eric Newman, and I'm joined today by my co-host and LARB Editor-in-Chief, Medea Ocher. Hi, Medea.
Hi, Eric.
So on this week's show, Medea and I had a fabulous time speaking with famed crime and mystery novelist Tana French about her latest book, The Hunter. And Medea, one of the things that you and I talk about books all the time, but I did not realize that both of us were such huge Tana French fans.
I know. I didn't either. I have been a huge Tana French fan since a friend of mine recommended her to me many years ago. And I think we had a copy of it at the office. And I read it and I thought it was just like fantastic. I just thought, you know, I kind of like ate it up in a minute, and then the rest of them followed. And I think the thing that she does so well that is so, I should preface this by saying I don't read so much detective fiction. I don't read so much crime fiction. And so my points of reference are sort of old school. They're kind of like the Chandler.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm basing things on. But, or like Richard Powers, I suppose, is like my most recent kind of crime detective novelist that I've read, is that she incorporates, one, like a really precise feeling of place and location that I think, I mean, you're just immediately in Dublin or in small town Ireland, and you know exactly, you have this feeling of like both the place and the sense of it, its surroundings, the people in it. I mean, she does it almost like seamlessly. You don't notice her doing it, and suddenly it's like an entire, you're in this entire world that she's built. And she does the same in this book, and where she, it's an invented small town. Yeah, talking to her, you know, I usually say like I'm rarely starstruck, and I'm usually starstruck by kind of weird people, like a background actor in Veep or something. But Tana French is really, you know, I did feel a little starstruck.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of detective fiction. So it's like I've read a lot of the stuff that you've read, but also the much more like pop culture stuff. Like I'm a huge fan of Robert B. Parker's Spencer novels. I've never read anything outside. I know his Jesse Stone novels are supposed to be very good. And I'm also a huge fan. Actually, this past holiday, so back in December, I read in maybe about 2 weeks all 8 of Michael Nava's Henry Rios mysteries, which were fascinating to me because they are detective fiction, but from the perspective of a lawyer, and he's a gay lawyer. So it's very rare to me, at least in detective fiction, to find a gay protagonist, and it's all set during the AIDS crisis. So, but Tana French, really, as you're describing her so well, she does have that incredible sense of place. Like even in The Wood and that kind of Dublin murder squad series, it is very different. And we talk about this in the interview. We talk about kind of how she's changing a little bit her approach, and that this does mark a shift. And that, you know, she talks about being inspired by the Western, for example. But even in The Wood, she really does get a great sense of just the Irishness of it all, for lack of a better word. Like she captures, like you're saying, a people and a place that feels so lived in, so real, even when she's inventing it, that you almost feel like you're very much there in the landscape with her. And that is truly exciting to read. And it has all the details and nuance of that local place. So you also feel like you're learning, even as you were saying, in this case, it's a fictional small town, you really feel like you're learning, I don't know, something about Ireland, or you're being transported to that space whenever you read her fiction, which is just truly exciting. And yes, I was also very much starstruck. There were so many things that I wanted to ask her and try not to fanboy too hard, but I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and think our listeners will too.
I think so too. And if you haven't picked up any of her books, just grab one and I pretty much guarantee that you'll love it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, should we get to that interview?
Let's do it.
We are more than elated to have best-selling crime fiction writer Tana French with us on the line today. Tana is the author of 8 novels, including In the Wood, The Witch Elm, and The Searcher. The winner of numerous literary awards, including the Edgar, the McCavity, the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction, and our very own LA Times Book Award for Best Mystery and Thriller, Tana joins us today from her home in Dublin to discuss her 9th novel, The Hunter. This latest crime story picks up where The Searcher left off, in Ardnakelty, a fictional town on the west coast of Ireland where retired Chicago detective Cal Hooper and Trey, the local teen who Cal has taken on as a kind of surrogate daughter and mentee, are rebuilding their lives. For his part, Cal is still trying to find his place among the townfolk in Ardnakelty, who treat him with a just-beginning-to-thaw sense of suspicion. Trey is trying to find peace in the wake of her brother Brendan's murder, a crime Cal investigated in the last novel and which brought him knee-deep into the dark and treacherous waters of the local culture. As Trey and Cal put their lives and local reputations back together through, of all things, fixing furniture, Trey's shifty father Johnny suddenly returns from London, this time with a friend who Johnny convinces the town can make them all rich at a time when scorching heat is destroying the local agrarian economy. As in all of Tana's dark and mysterious novels, everything is not as it appears to be. And as the covers get pulled back on its characters' true intentions and their nefarious connections, The Hunter burns slowly through a tale of the ties that knit together small communities and the ones that tear them apart. Welcome to the show, Tana. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's great to be on. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Maybe we could just talk a little bit about how you became a writer. It was not your initial career, and is now your very successful career. So how did you turn to it?
When I was a kid, this was actually the plan. I was going to be a writer, but I got sidetracked by acting for a while in there and had a great time doing that. But the thing about acting is, like, the gigs don't line up neatly unless you're Judi Dench or somebody, and I was not. So I had some time off between a couple of gigs and went, what I'd love to do is work on an archaeological dig. Found one that had a space for somebody and, yeah, got a few weeks' work on a dig. Thing was, there was a wood not far from the dig, right? And I was looking at it one day and going, that would be a great place to play if you were a kid. And I think this is what distinguishes the mystery writer's mind from the normal mind, is you are always looking for the potential mystery in everything. Because instead of stopping there like a normal person, I went, okay, so what if 3 kids ran into that wood to play? And only one came out and he had no memory of what had happened to the other two. Like, what would that do to your mind growing up, knowing that the solution to this mystery is somewhere inside you, but you cannot put your finger on it? And then what if he became a detective and a murder case drew him back to that wood? So I kind of scribbled the idea down somewhere and threw it in a box and went down to do the next show. But I found that piece of paper a while later and went, I really want to know what happens with that story. And of course, nobody else was going to write it for me. So I went, if I want to know what happens, I'm going to have to write it myself. I wasn't sure I could, but I figured I could probably write a scene and then another scene. And then suddenly they were adding up into a chapter. And then suddenly I realized that I was actually turning down acting work because I wanted to put the time into this book. And if you know actors, you know, like, they do not turn down acting work lightly. And that somehow has led me here. Feeling very lucky to be here.
I mean, obviously that should sound familiar to any Tana French readers. I wonder, did you also have this impulse? You said this was originally your plan to be a writer and that's what you had wanted to do. Was this also kind of how your mind worked when you were a kid? Did you also sort of see mysteries where you looked as a child?
I think I did, yeah. I've always loved mysteries. I mean, I don't even care what kind. I like the real ones, the fictional ones, the solved ones, the unsolved ones. It's the mystery itself that fascinates me. I can remember being about 6, and some school book had a comprehension page about the Marie Celeste, the ghost ship found drifting. And the version I heard, which I don't think is the truth, but it said it was found drifting with breakfast still cooking in the galley and everyone vanished, no sign of what had ever happened to them. And I can still remember lying on the living room floor, 6 years old, going, right, when I die, I am asking God what happened there.
That's really sweet. I mean, it's sweet
in a weird kind of way, but
yeah.
But yeah, well, definitely what, already fascinated by mysteries.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you just, you know, before we get into talking about this particular novel, what you continue to find exciting about kind of, however you want to call it, like mystery writing or crime stories. I mean, they have such an enduring appeal. And I think one that actually seems to, this is based on purely anecdotal evidence, but it has like really increased, I would say, over the last like 1 to 2 decades, like just this interest in true crime, but also in like just crime stories. And so what do you find grips audiences, and what does the kind of setting of a mystery novel allow you to do as a writer?
Oh, that is a lot of interesting questions all in one place. On why we love mysteries so much, I think part of it is we're programmed to be fascinated by mysteries. It's one of the things that makes us different from animals. Most animals, if they find something mysterious, they go, well, can I eat it? Is it going to eat me? Can I shag it? And if the answer to all of those is no, they're probably going to wander off. Whereas we are still fascinated. It's the mystery itself that catches us. But I think as a genre, it's also a really good way to explore the ultimate mystery, which is the human mind and the way it works and the way people interact. Because if you're dealing with a murder mystery, you're dealing with what takes someone to commit this ultimate earth-shaking act of killing another human being. And how do we deal with it? As individuals, as a society, how do we process this once it's happened? And mystery, obviously, is engaged with that from the start. So it kind of peels back the layers of how we work and how we interact in a lot of depth. And I think very naturally moves into those places. So I think that automatically makes it fascinating to us.
I want to ask you a little bit about how your relationship to the genre and to writing mystery has changed over the course of your career. Where does the story start for you? You know, you gave us this beautiful kind of anecdote about where In the Woods started, but kind of where do you start with the crime and then work your way backwards, kind of in an Agatha Christie style, to like figure out, okay, well, where do I want to open? How do I want to set it up? What are my red herrings? Like, how have those things shifted for you as you've kind of eased yourself into your incredible position in the genre?
To start with, when I started In the Woods, I didn't really think I was writing mystery. I thought I was writing just a book that had a mystery framework to it, which I needed because structure isn't my strong point, right? I feel quite at home writing character, atmosphere, writing good sentences on a sentence-to-sentence level, but structure doesn't come naturally. I have to work my ass off to give a book a solid structure. Left to my own devices, I would keep writing. The thing would be 300,000 words long. My deadline would be 3 years ago, and I'd still be going. So mystery's great for tying you down to a structure because it's got this defined shape, right? A kills B, C finds out who done it, and we're done. So it tells you where to start, tells you where to finish. And I leaned on that, I think, more heavily when I was starting out because I needed it more. So my first 6 books, I think, are much more cleanly structured to that shape where somebody gets killed at the beginning. And at the end, when someone finds out who done it, I know I can stop now. I know I can like tie up all the threads. And once I got a little more comfortable with structure, I think I felt more free to bend those structural shapes and the genre conventions. Like Witch Helm doesn't really start with somebody getting killed. I don't drop in the body until what, halfway through the book. Same for The Hunter. Nobody gets killed until, I don't know, I think it's like 2/3 of the way in. I think I'm more at ease with playing with the boundaries now that I've got enough experience to structure without them being too clean. Oh, sorry, you also asked where the ideas come from. And I totally tangented off that. A lot of my ideas have come from the same kind of thing as In the Woods, finding something, running into something along the way in ordinary life and going, where's the potential mystery in that? Like the idea for Faithful Place came from, I was walking home and saw a skip outside a house that was being cleared out. And there was an old blue suitcase in it. And I thought, how did that get there? How long was it in there? What might be in there? Who might be looking for that or not know where it had gone? And the story of Frank and the girl who he thought had left him. came out of there. So a lot of stuff is just ordinary things that could have a mystery in them if you look at them funny. But I don't normally start with a whole plot worked out. I don't normally start even knowing, like, I don't usually know who done it until I'm like 3/4 of the way through the book. No, normally I start with, I've got a setting, right? I need a setting. I need the sense of a core place and its atmosphere. And I need a really strong sense of the main character, who this person is. And I need a really basic premise. And then I just sort of dive in and hope there's a book there somewhere. And that as I write the characters and figure out who they are and therefore what they do for what reasons, the threads will tie up.
It's interesting to hear that, you know, your ideas come from you looking at something funny, because it's one of the things that strikes me about all of your books and yourself too, is that a central part of them is a person either coming back to a place that had been, that was familiar at some point, but they had been estranged from and so are now outside of, or in the case of the hunter, sort of starting a life anew. And the main character, Cal, is American, but he moves to the small town in Ireland and is very much, you know, an outsider there because it's a very small town. Everybody knows each other. Everybody's grandmother knows each other. Everybody's great-grandmother knew each other.
Yep.
and so what he provides in a way is this feeling of looking at something funny, right? Because he's not of that place necessarily. You have this like other perspective all of a sudden. I wonder, did you learn? I mean, it sounds like you've kind of had that forever, but I wonder if arriving in Ireland and stepping into this new place, you're American, you grew up in Vermont, right? Is that?
My dad's American, but my mom I'm a mix. My dad's American. My mom is part Russian, part Italian, born and brought up in Ethiopia. I grew up all over the place.
Oh,
I lived
did.
In Vermont till I was two, but I'm, yeah, full third culture kid here.
Okay. You're well practiced in this. You're essentially a pro in looking at things funny.
Yeah, being an outsider. No, I'm an expert. I'm good at that.
Wow, that's so interesting. So was there a point where you felt you'd settle down?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I moved to Ireland just after I finished school to go to college. And it also seemed like, you know, the natural place to go because there wasn't anywhere that I would have considered home at any place because I've lived in so many places and I'm from so many places. And Ireland was where I had the most friends from being here for summers when we lived in Rome when I was a teenager. So this just seemed like the natural place to gravitate. I knew people, I knew the place. I, you know, knew what bus to take to get around town. And I knew that once I got the chance to settle down, I was going to stay put, which I have ever since 1990, ever since I was 17. But that's never going to make you an insider in a place like Ireland, not a full insider. Like my husband, right? He's from an inner city Dublin neighborhood. His family is from there as far back probably as history goes. There are, you know, probably Viking skeletons from that area in the National Museum that are his great grandparents. That is where he's from. And that's what we consider roots here in Ireland. That's what we consider an insider. Mm. I'm never going to be that, but I do have this odd outsider / insider perspective where I can't really consider myself quite an outsider. I've been here 33 years now, but I'm never an insider. And I think that's a really good perspective for a writer to have. Because if you're just an insider, if you belong somewhere right to the core, there are a lot of things you're going to take for granted. The little societal conventions and codes, just the little ways people communicate, the little undertones, you're going to assume that those are the way things naturally are. They're the default. But if you've grown up like I have, where you're always moving from place to place, you're always having to pick up new sets of codes, you know there is no default. Everything is a signal that needs reading and needs awareness. And that's a really good place to be in as a writer because you're very tuned into these things because, you know, you don't have much option. If you move somewhere and you don't tune in quickly, you're going to put your foot in your mouth. There's going to be miscommunication all over the place. You need to tune in. And that is what you're bringing to readers. If you're a writer, you're trying to show them those little nuances by which the characters communicate. So I think the outsider-insider perspective is pretty useful.
Yeah. It also sounds like, you know, one of the things that you're doing as a kid, if you go from place to place, as another kid who also went from place to place.
Oh, you too? You were another?
Yeah. I grew up in Georgia in the Soviet Union, then moved to Moscow, and then moved to the U.S.,
okay, you've done the rounds too.
Not as many as you have. but some rounds. But I think one of the things that you're doing is like constantly solving mysteries, right? Like as a child, you're like cracking the code of like, well, when this person says this, how am I to behave? Or when I go over to this person's house and they offer me tea, I am trained to say, no, absolutely not, I'm fine. But I know that the process will unfold in this kind of way, right? That this person insists and then I have to agree, right? Like,
you'd fit right in Ireland. That's very Irish.
Right. But then in America, it's a little bit different. Like, you know, where it's actually more polite to say, yes, I would love that, rather than beg off, because then people kind of just take you for your word and don't insist. Anyway, so it strikes me that you were kind of doing that all the time. You were just cracking these codes left and right.
Yeah, you're trying to figure out what's the underlying meaning and what communication is going on here and what does it mean if so-and-so, you know, puts their hand on my arm. Is this flirtation? Is it just, you know, friendly physical contact? Mm-hmm. And of course, it depends on so many factors that you're having to take in. Yeah, you are approaching everything as a mystery, a code you need to solve.
I want us to turn to the hunter now. And in the same way, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit before we got on, but one of the most pleasurable things for me about the hunter is seeing the oblique and layered way that communication works among the characters, specifically the characters who are town folk as they communicate with Cal. So there'll be characters like Mart or Noreen, for example, speak a very, to me, recognizable from like my Irish grandmother, like way of, it's a coded, often circular or circuitous and suggestive language of kind of euphemism and allusion and inflection that, you know, your characters have to interpret and then themselves also manipulate in order to get information, you know, to understand basic things like who knows what, right? The basics of a mystery, who knows what, who did what, who was where and why. But it is also sometimes the only way that they can survive is kind of knowing how to manipulate and read these codes. So can you talk a little bit about this as a kind of Irish cultural phenomenon of how kind of communication works? And I think it is, again, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, I think this also has something to do with the West in Ireland, that it may be, in fact, unique to that area. But could you just talk a little bit about kind of how that helps you as a scene in which your characters are saturated, kind of how it helps you to build tension and engage a reader who is also trying to understand what these things mean?
Oh, man, that is so Irish. That's so very Irish. Not coming out with anything straight. You've got to go around it in narrowing circles, just touching on it from every different angle and hinting and throwing in little nuances. Yeah, that's a very, very Irish
thing. Pretending to be very open and forthcoming.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're being straightforward, just not about the thing you're really saying. You're being straightforward about something completely different. I always wonder if that's got some kind of resonance in being a post-colonial country, you know, a country that's been colonized for 700 years, where saying anything outright could be dangerous. You had to learn how to encode things and how to layer things under harmless layers. I wonder if it's something to do with that. But I tell you, it's so much fun as a writer, because it is no fun writing characters who are really good at straightforward communication. Your scene lasts like three lines, you know? You get one character saying, hey, I'd really like it if you would do this. And the other character going, I will, but I have this problem with it. And the first one goes, oh, okay, let's solve it like this. Yay, done with the scene. You know, that took me 2 seconds. Whereas if everybody has to go round in circles and approach things with great plausible deniability, and if another character is caught trying to interpret this, then only part of the tension lies in, okay, is A actually going to do what B wants him to? Half the tension is, wait, is A interpreting B correctly? What happens if he's not? Does B mean what he's saying he means? Or is there another layer of agenda below it, and another layer below that, and another layer below that? How many of these is A able to penetrate? And what happens if he missteps somewhere in between all these layers of meaning? It's much more fun to write than someone who, you know, my best friend's Danish, and she says, they're straight out blunt about everything. And that's wouldn't be nearly as much fun to write.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you is that The Hunter is the second in a series, as I was saying in the intro, that started with The Searcher. Witch Elm is kind of on its own. But they mark a pretty stark departure from your earlier work, you know, the Dublin Murder Squad novels, for example. And I think that that departure is twofold, like one in the kind of movement towards a more rural space with characters and a community that, at least as an American reader, is styled much more in the way of like a Western, right, than the kind of urban or suburban-based crime fiction of your earlier novels. And so I'm just curious what a place like Ardnakelty offers you as a writer, and kind of how is it a unique and different scene in which to explore crime, violence, and the relationships that sustain or reveal both?
Oh, it's so much fun writing a rural space. And it did come, you're absolutely right. It was Westerns that took me there, because someone whose taste I trust recommended that I should read Lonesome Dove. And I'd never read a Western before, just never thought it would be my kind of thing. And Lonesome Dove is, in fact, amazing. And then that led me on to True Grit and The Sisters Brothers. I was reading this stuff and I was going, this stuff has a lot of overlap with the West of Ireland in terms of the settings. You know, this sort of wild, beautiful, but harsh terrain where you're going to need real toughness mentally and physically if you want to make a living out of it. But there's also that sense that you're in a place that is very distant from the centers of power, both geographically and culturally, and where the people believe that the power brokers don't care about them and don't understand their lives. And if you want to make a cohesive society, a functional society here, you're going to have to make your own rules and you're going to have to enforce them yourself. And that shows up a lot in Irish drama, in plays like The Field, Playboy of the Western World. These are some of the classics of Irish drama. And they have that sense as well. And that sense of a tight-knit little community where things can get brutal very easily, partly because anything anyone does has an impact on the whole community in a way that it just doesn't in an urban setting. And if you write urban or suburban, the characters, they're connected to their own friends, their own families, but they're not knit into the whole community in the same way. If you think about it, if you live in a city, if you want to detach yourself from your community, have no impact on them, you can do that. You just make sure you don't turn your music up loud, you don't have a dog that barks all day, and you know, you're done. You're having no effect on the neighbors around you. But in a rural setting, that's not a possibility, partly because everybody knows you. By the time you're born, your relationship with most of these people has already been defined, and you're going to have to work pretty hard if you want to change that, because you are from this family and, you know, your granddad cheated somebody else's granddad out of something 60 years ago, and you are within that now. You're within that tightly woven tapestry. And that, of course, makes for a very different kind of book, because you can't tug any thread without all of the others responding. And that's also a lot of fun to write, because it adds layers, it adds complexity to every single relationship. No relationship can be just itself. It's always intertwined with others. It's hard to write, but it's fun.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We've been speaking with Tana French, author of The Hunter. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first, we have this week's book recommendation.
We have Leslie Jamison on the line with us today. Leslie's new book is called Splinters, and she is here to give us a book recommendation. Leslie, what book are you going to recommend?
I am recommending a book that is also coming out this spring. I promise I'm not breaking the rules, but I actually have this incredible confluence of events this spring where two of my former students who are both in the same thesis workshop in the fall of 2020, both have books coming out this spring. Emmeline Klein's book, Dead Weight, which is a collection of essays about disordered eating, and Eliza Callahan's novel, The Hearing Test. So I'm recommending them both, but I'll say a few extra words about Eliza's book, The Hearing Test, just because it feels connected to a lot of the things that we got to talk about in our hour. It's about the main character is a woman who suddenly experiences this radical loss of hearing. And so the book is sort of shrouded in this strange silence, but it's like the noise of the world falls away. And then there are all these eerie kinds of attunement. It's really a novel of like noticing and sensibility where you just are tracking this central character's mind with her antennae, just tracking like the kind of strangest, oddest, most, I don't know, uncannily ordinary and sublime moments of experience. She has a habit, this character, of Google walking, so she'll land somewhere on Google Maps and then turn it to that setting where it's like you're actually seeing the streets and the houses, and then she'll just go on these long walks through the streets in that way. And the whole book feels like that somehow, like you're in this version of the world that is, it is the world, but it's also the world entirely remade through the materials of this particular subjectivity. And it's just, it's not quite like anything I've ever read. So,
wow, it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. You guys should read it.
Well, I mean, I hope to. I'm excited about it. Can you tell us the titles of both books again and their authors?
Dead Weight by Emmeline Klein is the collection of essays about disordered eating. Yeah, among other things, like really amazing on the history of bulimia as a sort of second-class eating disorder in America. And the novel is called The Hearing Test by Eliza Callahan.
Both sound fantastic. I believe we just published a piece by Emmeline Klein, so if somebody wants to check that out on the website, you can. And congrats to your students, Leslie, and congrats to you for fostering some beautiful books into the world.
My students are amazing. It's so fun to watch the world get in on these secrets that I've been able to witness for a while, how brilliant they are. So,
well, great. I look forward to both of them. We've been talking to Leslie Jamieson. Her new book is called Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Tana French, author of The Hunter.
The other thing that it struck me as really hard to write about that you do really expertly in this book is the way that information passes in this kind of community, the way the news spreads and gossip plays this really central role for all of the characters. And I think that that can be really hard to convey, because you kind of have to say, well, then this person said this, and then but kind of changed it. And so I wonder what your thinking is about when you're thinking about the ways in which the communication works in this kind of place and the way which neighbors talk to each other. When you said like that you pull this thread and everybody sort of has to respond, what is the way that gossip or news sort of works in that kind of space? How does that affect how you tell the story?
Oh, yeah, that's not easy to do, because obviously you can't, as a writer, be giving every single step in the gossip process. But one of the things about it is it's kind of a locus of power. There are always a couple of people within any community like this who are the ones who know everything. All the information comes to them and they share it out as they see fit, as they consider it either necessary or desirable. And two of the major ones in this community are Noreen, who, you know, she's a shopkeeper. Of course, everyone comes into her shop. Of course, she hears everything. And she just likes handing it out by the armfuls. She just hands out every bit of information she's got to anyone who will listen. But then there's also Mart, who knows by less clear, less obvious methods, and who is much more careful and judges much more strategically where he's going to allocate all that information. So that means that when I'm writing a scene with one of those, it comes with connotations built in, which makes it easier to work. Because when Noreen throws out a piece of information, it can be assumed that she's just throwing out the info because she wants you to have some too. You know, she's got something, she wants you to have it. Whereas when Mart throws out a piece of information, he's doing it for a reason. He has an objective in doing it, sharing it with this specific person at this specific moment. Clearly, it's a warning, it's a command, it's a nudge, it's something. So once you start to think in terms of the underpinnings of gossip, it becomes easier to structure how info moves because it has that underlying layer as well.
So we've talked a little bit about, and it's so hard, I just want to acknowledge for listeners, it is so hard for me to talk about this novel without giving anything away, but like I would really be doing a disservice if I did. But so much of The Hunter hangs, I think, on various characters' attempts to repair or kind of move beyond their past in this way that you've been talking about. Cal is kind of thrown into this place, but everyone else is thrown into the pasts of their ancestors, right? Which they have to exist in and survive in the present. So we have, for example, Trey's desire to move past her brother Brendan's death, her father Johnny's desire to escape debts and also his local reputation, and Cal's desire, I guess, to kind of feel less like an outsider or a stranger in Ardnakelty. So I'm curious if this kind of theme of repair or the reparative was something that you came into the novel with. I mean, it does come out of a novel where there was serious damage to kind of local ties. Or did that kind of emerge as you were writing through it?
I think that came out of the character of Cal, because I was thinking of him right from the beginning of The Searcher as somebody who was very focused on things he did rather than things he thought. See, I was coming out of writing The Witch Elm, which is so introspective, and like the main locus of the action is inside the narrator's head. And by the time I finished that, like I loved writing it, up until the last 2 weeks when I was going, oh my God, this guy needs to pull his head out of his ass and start doing something. So for the next one, I was like, I'm going to write someone who does that. And that went very well with the Western theme, because Westerns tend to be about characters who are very action-focused. And Cal is someone who's like that. He doesn't think it matters what you think inside your head. He figures it matters what you do. You can think whatever you want, just do things right, try to do things well. And he is someone who wants to fix things. He spends most of the first book fixing up this house, fixing up the garden, fixing an old desk. And by this one, he's made a sort of slight, small under-the-table business out of fixing furniture and fixing himself up a garden. It's what he does. He repairs. He was trying to repair his sense of self in Searcher. And in this one, not so much. But in this one, I think he's very aware that Trey is still quite fractured or cracked in some ways from her childhood, which has not been an easy one, from the loss of her brother. And he's got an eye on her, on how that might manifest itself under any pressure, which it does, because Trey, for much of the book, is not consciously anyway focused on repairing herself in any way. All she's focused on is revenge, whichever form that might take. And Cal is trying to redirect her towards, away from basically, let's burn the place down to the ground, to let's try and do what fixes things. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do with a 15-year-old who has very little foresight and a lot of justification for revenge. But that's what he's trying to do.
You know, The Hunter also really, I think, pulls apart in these moments, right? So, I mean, another major repair is kind of they're doing physical repair of furniture, right? Making things that are broken kind of work again. But I think as you, especially in the triad of kind of Cal, Lena, and Trey, you see The Hunter kind of pulling apart the notion of family, and let's say, to use that like hackneyed phrase, the ties that bind people together. And for the most part, it seems that the novel suggests that the biological family is pretty unreliable, right? So here I'm thinking about the tension between Trey and her family, as well as, let's say, between Lena and her sister Noreen. It's less tense there, but there's like a lot of tension of Noreen trying to direct her life. But that in the place of a biological family, we might have a kind of chosen family, like we see with Cal, Lena, and Trey, that maybe the novel treats as more reparative and potentially a more sustainable form of social adhesion. So I'm just would love to hear you talk a little bit about how family and maybe chosen family or friendship works in The Hunter and kind of the world that you've created in Ardnakelty.
It definitely is. This chosen family, Cal, Lena, and Trey, they have built a sort of odd makeshift surrogate family-ish unit where Cal is sort of a father, Lena's sort of in a maternal role, Trey is sort of being the teenager, and none of it matches up exactly. to our idea of what a family should look like in a lot of ways. None of them live together, for example, and none of them are biologically related, but it works for them. It's a thing. I think there's a line in the book about Cal thinking of it as being like the dry stone walls that are all over the fields. It's been built out of necessity, out of what you've got around, and it's got gaps in it, and it looks like it might fall down, but somehow it's holding through weather. And I think for people for whom the biological family has not fulfilled the function of stability and support that you want it to, these chosen families can be huge. And for Trey, although her mother does in some ways definitely come through for her when needed, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the standard way that you want your mother to be there for you. And, you know, and her father, like, I mean, he's even more worthless when he's there than when he isn't. He basically sees Trey as a useful tool in his get-rich-quick scheme. That's all she is to him. And so Trey's coming into everything from that basis. And the family-ish thing she's built up with Cal and Lena is, in fact, very reparative. Because I think it's not something that came to them willy-nilly. It's something that they have constructed in order specifically to fit what works for them, what they need, what's supportive and solid for them as individuals rather than just as roles of mother, father, teenager. So I think in some ways that's being, for all of them, not just for Trey, a very healing, repairing thing.
This is somewhat on that subject, but, you know, it struck me when I first started reading The Searcher, which I think came out in, was it 2020?
Yeah, right in the middle of it all.
It was quite a complicated time for how we were looking and thinking about law enforcement, particularly in the United States, but certainly the world over. And I was wondering what your thoughts, you know, talking about this, the work of repair and having that be more of the focus, I was wondering what your thoughts were as you were kind of working with characters who are cops. Even in this book, you know, you have, I think, Johnny saying, like, no daughter of mine should be hanging out with a cop. Or something around those lines, more elegant than that and more Irish. But yeah, I was wondering what your thoughts were during that period of time when there was this a feeling of a reckoning in the middle of it all. And that this was really also who you write about and the kind of work that you write about and people who did that work.
It's an interesting place to be. I have to say that the Irish context is a little bit different from the American one in terms of our relationship with the police, with detectives. It's not in any way perfect, but it's a very different thing. It's probably a sociologist could go into it in much better depth than I could. But the place of the police within society, our relationship with the idea comes from such a different historical place that it's hard to compare it. But I do think that one of the pitfalls of the detective genre, and one that the genre as a whole has been moving away from more and more, is that if you stick to the perspective of the detective, it's highly slanted and it's highly limited. Because for any detective, the police investigation is going to be a source of power and control and the reimposition of order on chaos. And that overlooks so much about the other perspectives that are just as involved in the case. Because for anybody else who is involved in this process that we in the genre describe over and over of a police investigation, this is not something that confers power and peace and control or even necessarily justice or truth or any of these things. It may be completely divorced from any of these things. It's a process that can upend your life, possibly destroy it for people like witnesses, suspects, victims, and, you know, perpetrators, obviously. But it is not as simple as the format of the detective genre makes it seem often. And it's one of the reasons I moved on from writing the first six books, which are all from the perspective of a detective. I thought, I've been doing this over and over, and there are so many more perspectives within this story that we tell that also deserve a voice and that are also equally powerful, equally interesting, equally emotionally deep and resonant. And I wanted to give space to those. And so Wichelma kind of tried to do it all at once. You know, Toby bless his heart, does try to be the detective briefly at one point in the book, and it doesn't go well for him. But mainly at different points in the book, he's victim, he's suspect, he's witness, he's perpetrator, he's all these other things. And I thought, this is something that more and more mystery writers are doing, is giving space to those. And I think it's hugely important. And sorry to come by the long way around, back to what you were saying by Cal. In The Searcher, he is a detective who doesn't want to be a detective, whose faith in the job and himself as a detective is gone. He's got a line somewhere in there where he goes that he's realized that one or both of them, him or the job, cannot be trusted. So he doesn't know whether it's the job itself is inherently untrustworthy, whether it's him, or whether it's what the job has turned him into, or all of those. So in Searcher, he has tried to strip off all the detective in him, and then he finds it demanded of him. So he's being a detective, searching for Trey's missing brother, with none of the apparatus, none of the artillery of being a detective. He doesn't have his gun. He doesn't have people who he can call in and go, hey, could you dump this suspect's phone for me? Could you find out where so-and-so was on such and such a date? Could you look up the criminal record of such and such? He has none of the accoutrements of being a detective. So he has to come to terms with how much of being a detective is internal and is ingrained into him at this point, whether he likes it or not. And when does he use that, and can it be used for good when he feels that it's inherently an untrustworthy thing?
So as we wrap up, I've been fascinated by the way in which your books capture a changing Ireland, right, over the past like 10 years. I mean, one of the things that struck me so much throughout The Hunter, for example, is that you have, on the one hand, Ardnakelty, which is not a real place, but it can seem like a kind of idyllic Western Irish village that is frozen in time, except that these people have cell phones, they have Facebook, you know, even somebody like Mart, right, who seems like the most kind of like time-bound character, is talking about looking at things. I think he mentions looking on eBay for things and like other things. It's like, oh, this is actually like quite modern. And one of the other things that I found personally very touching is the inclusion of Trey still learning Gaelic in school. And this is oftentimes tied to, Cal, I think, says something like, she's complaining about having to learn Gaelic. And he's saying, you know, people died for your right to still speak that language. So there's a way in which history is kind of always the subtext in Ireland. It's not to say that it isn't everywhere. That's such a blandishment. It could apply to any place. But history is very potent in Ireland in a way that is, like I said, all the subtext. And yet you'll have, I mean, our family text chain was exploding with like the news that Michelle O'Neill from Sinn Féin was appointed first minister of Northern Ireland, right? Yeah. So we're like, I mean, that to my grandmother's generation, like that is unimaginable, you know? Yeah. And so I'm curious how you, from your perspective as a writer of very particular Irish mysteries, kind of witnesses or gives voice to a changing Ireland in your books as they develop.
It is a really hard balance to strike, and one that I'm never sure I have right, because the Irish perception of the relationship between past and present, it's a complex thing. It's very fraught and it's very sort of bruised and prickly, because the past is not necessarily a place that was particularly positive. There's a lot about it that we want to leave behind and erase. And I'm talking partly about the colonial past, where there's an urge to shake all that off, leave it behind. We'll, you know, knock down all the beautiful buildings and build something new and that's ours and that's modern. And yet at the same time, there's a clinging to some of the perceptions of heritage that are a little more idyllic, maybe. So it's a strange place to be in. We're still trying to get a hold on the fact that past and present can maybe coexist. There's always this sense that if you value the past in any way, you are somehow being anti-modernity and rejecting the flow of time, and you're clinging on to long gone things. Or, you know, if you rush forward into the future, you have to do it by knocking down everything that's historical or part of the past. We aren't yet at the point, I don't think, where we have a healthy symbiosis between the two. I hate the word synergy so much, but I think I might actually mean synergy here. We haven't managed to integrate past and present in a healthy and productive way. So if you're writing about that, if you're writing about a community that has traditions and relationships that go back centuries and has places even on a more concrete level that go back centuries, and that yet it's very much in the present, and everybody's got TikTok and everybody's got a mobile phone and everybody has the most modern farm equipment that they can afford because they need to have. You're always trying to find that balance, both as a writer and for the characters, in a country where that balance is still a very uneasy one and hasn't settled yet. I don't know if I did it right. I hope I got it right enough.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there is no... the right of Irish history and the present is like, I don't think there is any such place. I'm also curious, I mean, where do you want to go from here? Is this kind of the end of an Ardna Kelty suite in your writing? Or is there a kind of, do you have one more story or a couple of more stories that you want to return to Ardna Kelty for?
See, I hope The Searcher was a standalone. I wrote that as a standalone. And then I just went, no, but there's so many more fun Western tropes to play with. You know, the whole there's gold in them, there are hills, colders thing, and the revenge thing, and this relationship between these three people is just starting to be somewhere interesting. And so I wrote The Hunter, and now it looks like it was a trilogy all along.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
I figured that you had somehow picked up on that, because what you were saying about the idea of the sense of doom overhanging it, and a place that's at a dangerous moment in its history, that's under threat in some ways, culturally and physically. And also that arc of the outsider turning into the liminal person on the borderlands, it felt like that arc's not finished. There's a lot of thematic arcs that aren't done yet. So I seem to be working on the third in this odd little sort of mystery software on Western hardware trilogy.
Well, I was curious, when you first started writing, were you nervous about having Irish people read your work? Were you concerned that, like, am I going to get this right? Will I present this in the right way? Will I present the way that things are changing correctly? Have I interpreted this in the way that people will sort of recognize themselves in it?
Oh, yeah. I've been nervous for all the books, but luckily my husband, who's my first reader, is Irish. He reads them. Irish editors, there are plenty of Irish people reading these who are going to tell me if I screw up. And there's also the fact that I'm in practice, you know, as we talked about, I'm very in practice paying attention to cadences of language and, you know, the way people approach things. I was much more nervous with these last two because, you know, I'm in Dublin. I've always lived in Dublin. I've spent a certain amount of time down the west, but nowhere near the amount of time I've spent in a city. So when you start getting into rural stuff, you're going, okay, there are cultural differences. Every place has its very own cultural tones, and it's not the same. The priorities are not the same. The bases for community are not the same. The way people interact are not the same. They're little, you know, little conventions, like if you're going to call around to a neighbor, do you text them first or do you not? That will be different from country to city. So that I was more nervous about. But luckily I do, again, I have friends who are from rural Ireland and who are willing to give this a read and pick me up on anything that I got wrong, where, you know, where the sense of humor might be a little bit different or the phraseology might be just that little bit off. And who would catch me also if I was getting the characters' ages wrong. Because somebody who's from rural Ireland and is in their 60s doesn't talk the same way as someone who's in their 20s. So they were catching me up at all little tiny nuances. So no, I'm lucky. I've got people to vet that for me and make sure I don't go too far, hopefully.
So you have a passage in this book that really struck me, and it's in the middle somewhat, but you write, there's been this conversation about the gold in the hills. And so the men are meeting about it. And there's this moment where you write, the men are still, their land is changing from a thing they know inside out to a mystery, a message to them in a code that's gone unsuspected all their lives. Out in the darkness, the paths they walk every day are humming and shimmering with signals. And it struck me that that is also partly, you know, the power of a scam, I guess, but it's also the power of a story to suddenly make something so familiar feel new or feel unknown in some way. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little about that. Like, do you feel
Do you feel when you're approaching a new story, a new book, perhaps the third part of a trilogy that you've already been building, perhaps, do you feel a sense of this possibility of like familiar terrain suddenly becoming new or strange and having the sense of like, oh, I can do so much here?
That's what you want to do, isn't it? That's the ultimate aim, is to find whole new layers of meaning in things that are familiar and things that are mundane, is to find the emotional charge that underlies all of them. I remember talking, this is ages ago, with my acting teacher back in drama school about Chekhov, and him saying that the genius of Chekhov is that when one character says to another, would you like a cup of tea? They're not just saying, would you like a cup of tea? They're saying it because they're trying to annoy a third character who 2 pages ago didn't give them the attention they wanted. So they're asking somebody else for a cup of tea before they ask that third character. Everything is charged up with meaning and everything is vital. Little tiny mundane things have an urgency and have a power. And that, of course, as a writer, is what you're aiming to do, is to lay bare those layers of power and urgency under the little things, the little boring things. And it is especially when you're writing something that takes place in the same location as another book. You're going, but this time, there have to be entirely different meanings underlying the ones that I was working with last time. Everything here has to be charged with something new, something fresh. Otherwise, it's just the same book all over again. Nobody wants to read that. I don't want to write that. So you're going, what else is there? What else is in here that I haven't explored yet? And it is, it's scary, but it's really fascinating because any location, and especially a place like this, is going to have all the layers, if I can just put my finger on them.
Oh, what a gorgeous answer. Thank you so much.
I was just going to say, I think that's the perfect place to end, where we have scary, gorgeous, exciting, and also layered, which is basically every Tana French novel.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Tana French, author most recently of The Hunter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vlotten.